Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Illustrator Steve Fershad has created illustrations for magazines and newspapers and artwork for t-shirts. He has illustrated over 35 books. He was living in Paradise, California, when the campfire destroyed the town in November of 2018. Steve Fershad now has written and illustrated a diary of paradise before, during, and after the fire, as told by a young girl named Haley. The title of this children's book is My Name is Haley, and I Live in Paradise. Steve Fershad, welcome.
Yes, hello.
This book, as I looked, because illustrations fill every page, as I looked and read the book, I was thinking, gosh, this book is so special. And why is it special? I'm sure you must think it's special, Steve.
Oh, yes, I do. It's very personal to me. It was a very passionate project for me to work on.
Now, you have illustrated so many books. I mentioned 35 books. But as far as I know, this is the first book you have written. Is that true?
Yes, it is the first children's book that I have written and illustrated myself. I have done on my own. I just haven't gotten around to publishing yet because I had all the illustrations done for these other books and they were all destroyed in the fire, and silly me didn't get them scanned yet. So I'm starting from square one with those projects.
In fact, you just mentioned your work being destroyed in the fire, and I was thinking that you included so many characters, real characters, in Paradise, but you could have included yourself, but you didn't. If you were
I did. I'm in the parking lot. I have my back to you, but I am there in the Rayleigh's parking lot looking up towards Paradise.
But if you were to include yourself, what would you say?
What I'd say myself is just that almost what Haley is saying and is trying to say is just always to keep moving forward. You know, we've been through this disaster, but it doesn't mean we have to stop there. We could learn from it and keep moving forward and always just hold on to that hope no matter what's going on.
Well, you mentioned that your work was destroyed because your studio was your home, I assume.
Yes, it was. It was in the home.
So everything
I had, all the original artwork, just everything is gone. But that's just the way it is for now. So as somebody pointed out to me when I mentioned this, they said, yeah, but the creator of those art pieces is still here. And that's what I always hold on to. So
that is hopeful. Do you know, Steve, I don't know if you know, but I actually have a piece of your artwork framed and hanging on the wall of my living room.
Yes, it was the cover of the book about your walk. I can't remember what that trail is called over in Spain. Or
Camino, the Pilgrimage of Santiago de Compostela.
There you go, yes.
And you drew an illustration for that. So if you ever need some of your work, I have
you don't know how many people offered to return some originals to me. And my thought is the only reason those illustrations survived is because they are spread out all over. So I tell people just thank you, but hold on to them. So,
well, were you at home that day, that morning in November of 2018?
Yes, I was. As you know, I usually prefer to work at night. And so I just got to bed like 2 hours before we received the phone call to evacuate. It was a friend who called and just said, it was my significant other's brother-in-law who called and said to get out now, don't even bother packing, just get out. And he was right. This was that we left Paradise, or the house, at 9:30 in the morning.
So what did you grab?
The only thing I grabbed seriously was this this black box that had important papers in it, because you know we've been through evacuations before, and it's just another fire, we'll be back soon. And I'm sure a lot of people felt that way too.
Yes. So you grabbed a black box with important information in it, and you evacuated to Chico, did you?
Yes, and just waited in the, and drove through this, like, it's almost like what they show, or even the illustrations in the book are, you know, when Haley's going through the fire, those are pretty much my experiences from every little detail that I could remember. And then we drove down to Chico, which took about 2.5 hours to get down the hill.
Well, I mentioned that your story, the story that is told by Haley, this young girl, describes, you write a diary form before, during, and after the fire. And the before, of course, is very pleasant. She loves living in Chico. She has friends. In fact, who are the characters in your book, Steve?
Well, everybody in that book is an actual Paradise person. Some of the names I didn't know, but I just remember seeing them around their faces. And so I put them there. So everybody in that book is somebody from Paradise. You know, there's like the Hartleys who own Joy Lynn's.
Bill and Pam Hartley. You have a sketch of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And of course, Debbie LaPlante Mosley, who actually came up with the idea for the book, she approached me about doing the book. And I was totally on board with it because it just felt like the right thing to do. And she's the one who came up with the idea. And she also supplied me with a lot of photos of the local townspeople, you know.
In fact, that's one of the things I thought was special about this book was this woman, Debbie LaPlante Mosley, who is executive director of Youth on the Ridge Community Foundation. And she, this is my understanding, she had this idea of raising funds by auctioning off names and characters to be put in a book.
Exactly, and, yes.
And so that's why your character is named Haley, because the winning bid came from the Hartleys, Bill and Pam Hartley, who own Joy Lynn's Candies. And it's my understanding is that's their granddaughter, Haley.
That is their granddaughter. That is correct. And her name is Haley. And the other two kids were also won the bids, too. Her two friends.
Lucia, Violet, and Sam?
Are those they're actually real people. Sam is only about, I think he's like 3 years old. So I had to make him look older. And I had to make Haley look younger.
Uh-huh.
So it'd be around this certain age group.
Yes. Uh-huh. So on the cover of your book is a picture of this little girl. We assume it's Haley because the title of the book is My Name is Haley and I Live in Paradise. And she's holding a little dog and off in the distance, the fire is raging. How did you come up with the cover illustration?
The cover was, I just wanted a like I said, I just wanted to show, of course, Haley and like looking over her shoulder and not with a terrified expression or anything like that, but just with this almost, in a sense, a hopeful expression or just, but a contemplative expression. And of course, the fire itself in the background was taken from photos. I downloaded so many photos off the internet to get, I just didn't want to get the look right. I wanted to get the feeling right, too, about how it was living in paradise and driving through the fire and afterwards.
Yeah, you're right about the feeling, because if we just wanted the look, we could look at photographs. You could put together a book of photographs. But to get the feeling, you have created these illustrations of the people, the characters, the place. And describe your book when Haley, when everything's fine, this is before the fire. I said, what is Haley's life like before the fire?
It was perfect. It was just like living in paradise. It was just such a nice town to live in, you know, with all these community events going on and everybody for the most part were friendly. And like even Haley says, you know, she refers to gold nugget days and finding gold in paradise. And she says there's all, you know, about finding gold, but it's in within the people of paradise. And that's what paradise was like. It was really a special place to live and it will be again. You know, it's the people are still there.
Well, that's one reason I feel that this is, even though it's a children's book, it's for us adults too, because as I'm reading through your book and looking at the illustrations, you mentioned Gold Nugget Days, the Gold Nugget Museum, Johnny Appleseed Days. And so these brought back memories, even though I'm not a resident of Paradise, it's close enough that those of us in the surrounding area enjoy these events. And then the Chocolate Fest is special relating to this book too. Why is that?
Because the Chocolate Fest itself is also a fundraiser for the Youth on the Ridge Community Foundation. And so that's what made it very important. And because of things and, you know, with COVID, they are not being able to have the standard, you know, live, you might say, Chocolate Fest. So that's what we're hoping with this book too, that it could make up for some of the money lost by not being able to have the Chocolate Fest this year. And so,
So you might mention that the proceeds from your book go to this Youth on the Ridge Community Foundation.
Yes, it does. 100% of the profits do go to the Youth on the Ridge Community Foundation. And everybody, like, it's just not me. It's this whole community that got together to put this book together. There's Jessica and Les Cummings from Digital Print Design. They're also campfire survivors, and they're the ones who put the book together. And they donated their time. Virginia Partain, the editor of the book, also a campfire survivor, donated her time. And so it's just not me who put this book together. It's a community project.
My guest is illustrator Steve Fershad, and he has written and illustrated a book based on a concept by Debbie LaPlante Mosley. The title of his book is My Name is Haley and I Live in Paradise. And Steve writes this in the form of a diary by this young girl named Haley. And she starts out telling us about the pleasures, how much she loves living in paradise, and mentions some of the events, some of the places. And then one morning the phone rings and you have her describe, and you say that what happened to her was based on what your experiences were.
That is correct. Basically, like I said, it's all taken from my memory. Like I said, that's how it was driving through the fire, and that's what it felt like.
Well, you make this transition from life before and life during. You have Haley write or say, "Paradise was always a great place to live until that day. I woke up happy. The day before was my birthday." Was that really the case? It must have been.
No, it wasn't. The case for Haley, it was just something that we went to throw in about. So, you know, when she talks about hoping to get a puppy for her birthday.
I see. Yes. So that's how you work in the fact that that little puppy is on the cover of your book.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. And so she mentioned she'd gotten some really great presents, but what she really wanted was a puppy. And yes. You have her say, "I don't mean to sound spoiled or anything, but what girl doesn't want a puppy?" And then the phone rings. And you have her answer it. And it was her mother's friend, Mrs. Mosley. So you get Debbie in the story. It was, yes, Mrs. Mosley. "She told me not to worry, but there was a fire in paradise. She then asked me to give the phone to my mom. I handed it to her. My mom talked to her friend and got a worried look on her face." Now, that part is your artistic license, right? That it was Mrs. Mosley calling?
Yeah, that's a that is artistic license. It was actually a man who worked for Sierra Pacific who gave us calls. His name's Karen and O'Leary. And like I said, he just said, "Just get out now. Don't even bother packing." And he was right. I mean, I didn't know how bad the fire was until we actually hit paradise, actually started going down the skyway.
Well, you have in this photograph with her mother on the phone, looking worried. And you have on the wall a picture of family. It looks like maybe grandparents.
Yeah, those are my parents in the photo in the background.
So you have a lot of little touches like that.
Yeah, even the jacket she's wearing. She's wearing this olive green denim jacket because that's what I was wearing when I left the fire.
Oh, my. Well, the page before has a crowd of people. This lady's holding it looks like an apple pie. And you drew this lady so carefully that I'm sure she is a real person.
She is. That is Lori Crowder, who's, yes.
You said Mrs. Crowder bought us an apple pie before they sold out. And so you also have other people in the background of this picture, which I assume too are real people that you have drawn.
They are all, yeah, paradise people.
So I'm sure it's fun for them to look through your book and say, "Oh, that's me in this illustration."
Yeah, they've been having, it's been a little game for them to figure out who's who in that book. Yes. And like I said, some people I didn't even know the names of. It's just people I remember seeing around paradise. So people have been telling me who that person is.
And then you continuing in Haley's diary, "Mom told me to grab my backpack. She went into her room and got a black box with a lock on it." And you've already told us that's exactly what you did. You grabbed a black box. "When we got outside, there was ash falling all over the place. At first, I thought it was snow. The sky was all smoky. I could hear these booming sounds. "Come on, Haley, get in the car," my mom said. "I talked to your father, and he said that he will meet us in Chico. He told me that they dot, dot, dot." And then my mom got silent. "Just get in the car, Haley." We drove down the driveway. I saw all these animals running about as we left my home. You must have seen that too, Steve.
Yes. Like from the fire on, especially what got me, I mean, what really shook my nerves. When I first heard about the fire, I was pretty calm. But when I started hearing that, I guess it was propane tanks exploding. And it was this booming sound, this continual booming sound. And that's what sort of rattled my nerves a little bit. But for considering what was going on, I was surprised how calm I was through the whole thing.
And continuing, Haley says, "I saw that my mom was worried and said," and she said, "Don't worry, hon, we'll be back soon. You've been through evacuations before. This is no different." And that's what you said you felt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct.
But it was different. We didn't get very far when we saw that everything was on fire. Cars were already backed up. There was fire on both sides of the road. The wind blew flames and sparks across our car. Mom tried not to act scared, so I tried not to act scared too. So they're evacuating to Chico, and you have a sketch of some people directing traffic. And I recognized this gentleman directing traffic, Steve. Who did you illustrate? Who did you sketch there?
Yes, there's Steve Crowder, because he was actually there directing. And then, of course, there's Sheriff Honia, who was up there, who
Sheriff
did
Honia's
an outstanding job. So,
yeah, he was a real hero there. You have Sheriff Honia in the center with his flashlight directing traffic. And you have Haley say, "Cars were bumper to bumper. We tried to go one way, but we were directed to go another way. Even though it's daytime, the sky was dark as night. I couldn't see where we were, and everything felt wrong. It got really hot in the car. It was hard to breathe. We couldn't roll down the windows because of all the smoke. As we slowly drove down the skyway, I watched the whole town burn up." And you say you are basing this on your own experiences.
Everything from, you know, whenever that was, you know, every time there was a gust of wind, these flames would shoot across your car. And I wasn't really too worried about the car catching fire, even though there were cars that were already on fire on the side of the road. I was more worried about a tree falling and blocking the people's exit out of paradise. That was my big concern at the time.
Yeah. You have her say all the booming sounds sounded like a giant fire monster getting closer and closer. I kept hoping that my mom would drive faster. And you probably were wishing you could drive faster, but you could not.
Yeah, that is correct. And it was hard to see the road. I just remember it was like driving through a thick fog, just focusing on the taillights in front of me.
After a break, Steve Fershad and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Steve Fershad, author of My Name is Haley, and I Live in Paradise. Well, you have a sketch of that iconic paradise sign welcoming people to paradise, and it's on fire. And I'm guessing maybe the car that you have in the illustration is maybe your car?
It's the car I own now. I drove this old Buick LeSabre, and I was so worried about it overheating since the car wasn't moving fast enough. But no, that is my car. Yes, that is correct.
So they passed the paradise sign, and then Haley says, "Then suddenly there was blue sky. It just happened. I looked at my mom. Her lips were still moving, but this time I could hear her. She kept saying over and over, thank you, thank you, thank you. It seemed to take forever, but we made it to Rayleigh's parking lot. And I'm guessing maybe that's where you drove to Rayleigh's parking lot, Steve?
Yes, that's it. We got there, and there's already a lot of people there. In fact, there's all these people lined up along the road just looking up towards Paradise and seeing this plume of smoke. And there's all these people in the parking lot, and you could tell some of their nerves were rattled. They're just trying to get hold of other people. And, you know, and there's some lady who was just crying. And what I was impressed with is how many people, even though they didn't know who she was, they were just trying to comfort her. This fire was a bad thing, but at the same time, I saw that it brought out the best in people too.
Yeah, that was my impression also, Steve, because out-of-towners, when they came, would say, well, didn't Chico people resent these evacuees flooding into their town? I said, not at all. I was so proud of the residents of Chico who opened their arms, their houses, and to comfort the evacuees.
No, I thought Chico was outstanding with what they did. And that's the reason I want to do this book, is it was just my way of, I can't pay back Chico, but it doesn't mean I can't pay it forward.
Yes.
You know, with their kindness. You know, I'm reminded of the quote from the movie Starman with Jeff Bridges when they asked him what he liked about the human race. And he just said, he goes, sometimes when you are at your best, when things are at their worst. And that's what you got to see in Chico that day. It was absolutely incredible how Chico came together to help all these people. And I wish that would get out more instead of just talking about the fire. It's just the positive side of it, how all these people came together to help us.
My guest is Steve Fershad. He has written and illustrated a children's book. My name is Haley, and I live in Paradise. As they're driving down, when the sky clears, we see sitting on their dashboard, Steve, looks like a paper bag. And you don't mention it in the story. And I was wondering, what's in the paper bag?
Well, actually, there was something else there, but we changed the story. But that's how it was. You're just grabbing anything, you know, like my significant other at the time, grabbed a bunch of food out of the cupboard, just grabbed some food, some snacks, just so we'd have something to eat.
That's what I'm guessing, because it looks like
There was a bag, yeah, food.
A lunch bag.
Yeah, just a little snacks to eat. So that's just, again, this book is basically, just not my experience, it's probably everybody's experience that lived in Paradise that day. But it is very personal to me.
Well, as you have mentioned, the scene in the parking lot was very heartwarming. And we see Haley's parents. The mother runs up and gives her dad a hug, so we know things turn out okay for her. But they couldn't return to Paradise right away. And you tell the story before, during, and after the Paradise fire. So the fires happened, and you mentioned that people they didn't even know gave us clothes, shoes, toothbrushes, food. She says it was like Christmas. And you said that they found.
And that's what it felt like. It did. Like I said, it was just amazing. In fact, a lot of the clothes I wear now are the clothes that were given to me by people. Mm-hmm. And they sort of hold something special to me, you know, in a way. Especially one was this leather bomber jacket. Because I lost two of them in the fire that were very important to me, because one belonged to my uncle who passed away and one belonged to my younger brother who passed away. And somehow this new leather jacket, just because somebody gave it to me without knowing, I lost leather jackets. And it suddenly became so important to me, just the meaning of that.
How nice. Well, Haley writes, one day as we were walking Bidwell Park, my dad got a phone call. Dad sat us on the bench and said he just heard from a friend that our home was burned up in the fire. I got really sad. So did my mom. And I'm guessing that when you left, you didn't know. Did you know that how long did it take you before you knew your home was burned?
It was, I think, a couple days later. Somebody, I can't remember who was, knew that our house was burned down. And then later on, they took pictures and sent it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we knew for sure. You know, it was just shocking to see. And maybe it was longer than that, but till we found out our house was gone. But I was sort of prepared for that just by hearing other stories that it's going to be gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you include an overview of the town of Paradise that's burned, just ruins. And you have them go to the place where their house once stood, and the whole neighborhood was gone. And the only thing I recognized was our chimney. Was that the case for you, Steve?
Yeah. In fact, that's basically taken from my house, pictures from my house.
Yeah.
So when that's our chimney, that was the only thing basically left standing. It was a sort of like this adobe block home. So there's these walls that were still up, and, you know, it sort of looked like it reminded me of the Alamo for some reason, you know, with these old walls still standing, but everything inside was gone.
Well, you have her dad find this old football trophy. Did you find anything in the ashes that was salvageable?
One thing I do, and I put in the story, was the desk, my drawing table desk chair. And that's basically what was left of it. But there was hardly anything. Everything. What I shocked about, we couldn't find any doorknobs. That's how hot the fire got. It melted everything. And the only thing that you might say salvaged of value was my grandfather's ring. It wasn't in the best of shape, but old gold jewelry, they cleaned it for free, and then they repaired the ring itself. So, but that's the only thing that I basically got out of the fire.
Well, one part of the story I think you put in there just because it's heartwarming, that this puppy that Haley wanted, they found a puppy. You said a sound came from a pile of rubble. I softly walked over to the sound. It was a puppy. Was skinny, shaking, and scared. And I'm guessing that you put that in there, that it didn't really happen.
Yeah, I put that in there, but you heard stories and you did see animals when you're out there. You saw these scared little animals walking around Paradise. Hmm. And they were terrified. They wouldn't even come up to you, some of them, when you saw them.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But they were just roaming and they were hungry and everything, so.
Yeah, you described the puppy as dirty with ash. Smell funny, but of course Haley didn't care. And then you have a sketch of the framing of their new house, and Haley's going to, you have her name the puppy Phoenix, like the great bird that rose out of the ashes, and her parents thought that was a good name. So you have a conclusion, but it's as you say at the end of your book, it's really not the end. It's just the beginning.
Yes. And that's how it is. We're getting ready to rebuild soon. And it's just a long process. And that's it. That's what I'm looking at. It's a new beginning where somebody said it's like somebody pushed the reset button. You know, we're just starting over. And I think things are going to be better, you know, because they're trying their best to do it right this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for writing and illustrating this very special book, Steve. Thank you.
It was my honor. It really was. When they asked me, I was honored to do it.
My guest has been author and illustrator, Steve Fershad, and his newest book is My Name is Haley and I Live in Paradise. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Nancy. It's always my pleasure.
After a break, I'll be talking to best-selling author Brian Stevenson, whose book Just Mercy was made into a movie. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Next guest has been called a real-life, modern-day Atticus Finch, who through his work in redeeming innocent people condemned to death has sought to redeem the country itself. Desmond Tutu called Brian Stevenson America's Nelson Mandela. His founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit committed to fighting poverty and challenging racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. He has argued 5 times before the Supreme Court and is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and is on the faculty at New York University School of Law. Brian Stevenson, welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf. Your book, Just Mercy, is about mass incarceration. That's a tough sell. So what compelled you to write this book?
Well, I'm just persuaded that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, if they understood the things that I've learned over the course of my career, they would really want change. What we're doing in many parts of this nation is simply unacceptable. We're just tolerating abuse and cruelty and injustice in ways that I don't think most people would accept, but there's this information gap. And the book was really an attempt to bridge that gap, to get people closer to the realities of mass incarceration and to, I think, the shame of what's happened to too many people for too long.
Well, you know what I like is that you shake us out of our indifference with a story. And what was this story that got you started on this path?
Well, I do think that narrative is really important. We understand things much more intimately when they're framed by narrative. That certainly would happen to me. I was a law student about to reconcile myself to a career as a lawyer that I knew was not going to be fully affirming, not going to be terribly gratifying when I went to Georgia to work with lawyers representing people on death row. And it was meeting a condemned man who was burdened with chains, handcuffs on his wrists, shackles on his ankles, a chain around his waist, and seeing him respond to just my presence, to just being told that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year, to see how, even in my ignorance, I could have an impact on the quality of this man's life was really quite powerful for me. And then we had this long conversation where we were just talking and discovering that we weren't so different before guards came into the room and treated him pretty roughly, threatened him, and were putting the handcuffs on very tightly. And before they forced him out of the room, this man looked at me and he said, Brian, don't worry about this. You just come back. And I write in the book about how this man then did something I've never forgotten. He closed his eyes, he threw his head back, and he started to sing. And he sang this old hymn, I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And that man's song changed me. I really knew that I wanted to help condemn people get to higher ground, but mostly I knew that my journey to higher ground was tied to his journey. And it's experiences like that that have absolutely shaped my relationship to the work that I do, to my mission, my purpose, my career. And I think that's what narrative can do. That's what experience can do. It can make you step away from indifference and activate you in ways that I think can be absolutely transformative.
Because you write that you weren't even a lawyer yet. You were just a law student. You go in to meet this man thinking, what in the world am I going to say to him? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And he reassured you.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the real challenge, Nancy. I think that we've got to get proximate to the places and the people who are oftentimes marginalized, who are abused, who are neglected. We think that we can solve problems from a distance, and our solutions don't work because to really be effective, you've got to get proximate. We've been taught, many of us, that if there are bad schools in our community, if there are places where there's violence and despair or drug addiction and dependency, if there are areas where there's abuse and neglect, to stay as far away from those places as possible. I think if we want to change the world, if we want to create more justice, we've actually got to get proximate to the problems. I got proximate to condemned people, and what I learned was that I could actually make a much bigger difference than I thought I could. There's power in proximity. And that man taught me that, and my clients have been teaching me that over the last 30 years.
Well, I was struck by John Stewart's words. He said, discussion of this topic has been white people yelling at each other.
Yeah, I don't think we've done a very good job of even creating a forum for honest discussion. I think we've really been corrupted by what I call the politics of fear and anger. Our politicians have been competing with each other over who can be the toughest on crime, and that has facilitated a discourse that's not even about correction or recovery or rehabilitation or good policymaking or good governance. It's just about showing how tough we are. And whenever a society allows itself to be led by fear and anger, it will tolerate abuse. It will tolerate injustice. And we've seen that in the criminal justice system for the last 40 years. I'd like to think that we're turning a corner now, but it's not inevitable. We've got to have people change that narrative of fear and anger and embrace something more redemptive, more hopeful, more integrated into our values and norms and morals as a larger society.
And you make the point that when a mistake is made, we don't like the errors pointed out. We can resist confronting them. And it took 6 years to get a court to overturn Mr. McMillan's conviction.
One of my great frustrations is that our legal system is much more committed to finality than it is to fairness. And you see that in these cases where there's oftentimes obvious evidence of a wrongful conviction, and courts and judges are too frequently looking for reasons to avoid having to correct these mistakes. I don't know why we don't have conviction integrity units in every state, in every prosecutor's office. I don't know why a prosecutor thinks that his or her role is to just maintain the status quo. If there's a problem, we all benefit by correcting that problem, but we don't have that consciousness yet in our criminal justice system, and that's one of the great challenges. Our system is really unreliable right now. I am persuaded that we have more innocent people in jails and prisons today than we have ever had in our history. You cannot go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 and 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today and not have a corresponding increase in the number of innocent people wrongly convicted, particularly where I think we still have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, is shaping outcomes in too many jurisdictions.
My guest is Brian Stevenson, and he wrote a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And in some cases, you have to go to the court of last resort, 60 minutes. You have to go to TV and tell the story on television. You refer to that as the court of last resort.
Well, I do think that there is this barrier between what happens in jails and prisons, what happens in courts, that shields people from understanding what's going on. And transparency and exposure and revelation are key components to how we're going to get reform. In the McMillan case, which I detail, we went to 60 Minutes not because I think it was going to be key to winning the case, but we couldn't create a narrative about Mr. McMillan's wrongful conviction through the local press. We have, I think, in too many places, this kind of entanglement between the media and local law enforcement and local power structures where everybody protects the dominant narrative, which is that we don't make mistakes. We always get the right person. There is no unfairness, inequality, or injustice in our system. And when media becomes complicit in reinforcing that narrative, even when it's not true, you got to shake things up. And there are a handful of entities and institutions and national perspectives that have made shaking things up a little easier. It's in some ways easier today because the internet has, I think, given us all a little bit more access to create counter narratives in places where they're desperately needed.
Well, you mentioned, you tell the story, for example, of Walter McMillan and other stories of adults, but you also, there are stories about children, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. One of the real tragedies of the last quarter century, 40 years or more, is what we've done to kids. I mean, we created a narrative in America that there are some children that are not children. They may look like kids, they may act like kids, but we said these are not children. We came up with a new term in the 80s. We said that these are, quote, super predators. We use that rhetoric, that language, to justify horrific policies. There are now 14 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. We've got thousands of young kids in adult jails and prisons where they're at risk of being sexually assaulted and victimized. We've put tens of thousands of kids into adult prisons for decades. And I think we just gave up on a generation of children, mostly black and brown kids, and the consequence of that is really shameful. And I document the pain and the anguish I've seen when 14-year-old boys are put in jails where they're sexually assaulted and abused, or where kids are put in circumstances where they are denied the opportunity to develop as healthy human beings. And some of what's happened in that arena is nothing less than cruel and barbaric.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you give these people a name for us. You tell their stories, because I was born and raised in Georgia, and my dad was like other people of his generation in that culture. As long as we called them colored people, those other people. But when it came to someone he knew,
right,
a friend, he was so compassionate and he recognized the injustice. But
yeah,
he had to know that person and know them by name. And I think that's what you've done for us.
Well, I think it really is the great power of literature and storytelling. I've seen that dynamic that you described with your father with lots and lots of people. I think we're all much more motivated to stand up for people when they're being unfairly treated, to intervene, to say things that need to be said when we recognize that someone we know, someone we care about, our brothers, our sisters, our neighbors, are being mistreated. It becomes personal to us because they are personal to us. And the one thing I wanted to do was to make the clients, the children I've represented, the adults I've represented, the women I've represented who've gone to prison at such astonishingly high rates. We've had a 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison in the last 20 years. I wanted all of those people to be known and knowable to readers, because I am persuaded that, like your dad, the more we become aware, the more intimate we become with the community of people who are being victimized, the less acceptable their victimization is. And we need some of that outrage, some of that indignation to create the moral courage, I think, that's going to be required to dismantle mass incarceration and excessive punishment.
My guest is Brian Stevenson. He is a lawyer, an attorney, and he has written a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. One of the touching stories you tell in your book is a condemned man's last day, and all day long, what do you want for breakfast? And what was his reaction?
You know, it really was challenging. It was an early case that I did, and we'd had such success in blocking executions that when we couldn't block this one, it was very difficult. And I went down to be with him before the execution. This was at the time when they still used the electric chair in Alabama. And he was telling me just how strange the day had been. And when I got back there, it was just a few minutes before the execution, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange. All day long, people have been asking me, what can I do to help?" He said, "When I woke up, they asked me, what do you want for breakfast? At midday, they said, what do you want for lunch? In the evening, they said, what do you want for dinner?" And he said, "They kept coming to me saying, what can I do to help? Can I get you stamps to mail your last letters? Can I get you water? Can I get you coffee? Can we get you the phone to call your friends?" And this man said to me in those last few minutes, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange." He said, "More people have asked me, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life." And I was holding his hand thinking, yes, where were they when you were 3 years old and your mom died? Where were they when you were being physically abused? Where were they when you were being assaulted? Where were they when you were drug addicted and homeless? I know where they were when you were accused of this crime. They were lined up to execute you. And that difficulty, that disconnect was really, really challenging for me to have this man have the hair shaved off his body, then pulled away, strapped into an electric chair and executed, was difficult, but it was almost our inability to recognize that more could have been done, should have been done at a time when it had been meaningful. That was the real hard takeaway for me. And I vowed to him that we would fight harder to get people the help they need, to engage in work that could prevent these tragic outcomes. And it's been the direction of the work we've tried to pursue here at the Equal Justice Initiative.
Well, you're a graduate of Harvard Law School. You could have had a comfortable life like your classmates, I'm sure. What keeps you going?
You know, I really believe that justice is a constant struggle, and if you don't struggle to fight for the things that are important, you're going to see retreat, you're going to see injustice. And I think seeing what I've seen, knowing what I know, I really couldn't be comfortable doing anything else. I don't I don't feel for me like there's a choice. If you see something that you can fix, if you see someone you can help, and you know that if you don't fix it and if you don't help, there's going to be suffering and pain, you just do it because you have to. It would be hard to live. It would be hard to be at peace without doing that. And I think that's what's happened to me. And I feel in many ways that's been modeled for me by generations of civil rights activists, people who stood when other people told them to sit down, people who spoke when other people told them to be quiet. They have modeled for me the necessity of giving voice to the things that need to be heard. But more than that, they've modeled for me the power that you feel, the energy that you gather when you stand in the place that you think you are required to stand in the name of justice, in the name of what's right. And I often feel that sense of empowerment, that energy, and that makes it much easier for me to do the things that I do, to keep fighting, to do work, than it would be for me to be silent, stop.
One of Paradise's most well-known boutique businesses was Joy Lynn's Candies. And today I've invited into the studio Bill Hartley, who was owner of Joy Lynn's Candies. So, Bill Hartley, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Now, I see you're owner of Joy Lynn's Candies. And what happened to you on November 8th, 2018?
That morning, I was driving to work to Joy Lynn's Candies and saw the orange sky north of the candy shop and thought that looked a little strange and wasn't quite aware of what was going on until moments later when I received a call from a friend that said the hospital was on fire. And I knew that that was a rapid spreading fire and that we had better think about not opening for the day. Then as later reports came in, we found that the fire was closing in on the core of the town, and it was time to leave and evacuate. So I had called my wife, Pam, she was still at home, and said, we're leaving the shop. And she said, grab the cookbook.
Yeah, because people, when they're faced with that situation, what do you grab? And
It's you know, it's still very emotional and devastating. But there, you grab the things that are important, your computers,
your
our case, we didn't have animals there, but your photos and anything of you, that's a keepsake if you have time. And for us, the cookbook was the treasure that we wanted. And our computers with all, you know, our records.
Well, how long had you been owner of this candy shop?
20 years.
20 years.
Right. This shop was celebrating its 50th anniversary this year.
So there's a previous owner.
There's three.
For the first few years, and you picked up at, you've been there 20 years. So who owned the shop before you had it?
Oh, well, actually it was Anna Lee Harris was the owner, and she was married to a dentist. And it was always kind of interesting that a dentist would have a candy shop.
Well, it kind of makes sense. If you want to increase your business, you encourage people to eat sugar, mm-hmm. huh?
Right. So, yeah, I had retired from 29 years of police work and was looking for something interesting to do and finding happy people. And my wife was doing the same. She'd worked for the school district, and we thought it would be such a sweet pace of life to change and see happy people.
Did your background in police work serve you? Was there any correlation, anything you could draw on from that experience that day?
I think so. A lot of it was public relations, dealing with the people that come in and talk about what we have to offer at the candy shop. And that was very useful, actually.
Well, you say that that among your confectionery concoctions was peanut brittle made with Sierra Nevada pale ale.
Yes, that's a big hit, and we wholesaled that item. And at the time of the fire, we had Sierra Nevada was selling that product as well as 35 other stores. So it was a great product for us, and that's one of the first products that we will bring back when we reopen, hopefully by December of this year. We had purchased another building that had survived the fire, only a third the size of what we had, but it will get us started again and get us on our feet, and we look forward to seeing those smiley faces coming back through the door.
Well, maybe one of those recipes in the recipe book you salvaged was for the peanut brittle.
Oh, definitely.
And I'm wondering about the label brittle, peanut brittle. Was it brittle?
Oh, yes. Yeah, if you had peanut brittle, it's a crunchy bite. But this brittle was a nice somewhat of a soft crunch, not a hard crunch, which made it very special.
My guest is Bill Hartley, and he is owner of Joyland's Candies in Paradise, and he is profiled in Douglas Keister's book, People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise. And you have this new location, and you're planning to reopen your business. But you also, isn't your son and his wife, aren't they involved with the store?
Yes, we had actually sold the business to them 3 weeks before the fire. We retained ownership of the store itself. They have ownership of the business. So we felt an obligation that when we lost the building to buy another building for them to get started again. So we're kind of an effort, a collaboration between the two.
Well, we wish you all the luck in the world opening your new candy shop, Joyland's Candies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Phil.
This has been Bill Hartley, and he is telling us his story of the Paradise Fire. He's profiled in Douglas Keister's book, People, Places, and Pieces of Paradise. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank my first guests, Steve Fershot, author and illustrator of My Name is Haley and I Live in Paradise, and also Haley's grandfather, Bill Hartley. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.
Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.